Last Word on Today FM.
For today's Culture Club, we're delighted to be joined by Colm McInamara, who is one of our most accomplished and acclaimed composers and musicians. He's a founding member of Keela, a member of The Frames. He's a solo artist. He's a film composer. Colm, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Well, pleased to be here, Matt.
Do you know what we're going to do, though? We're actually going to play a little bit of music to start off, a little bit of music to let people know of the type of work that you are doing. So let's just hear this. Tell us about that, please, Colm.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. That's the first time it's been heard on the radio, and it's the first time I've listened to it. It was premiered last night. It was a commission from the British Council. I was invited to write a piece of music as part of their Entwined Lives series of events that they run every year. And I suppose I was primed for it from having worked on, I was working on a four-part documentary on the history of Ireland that Brian and Nick Dermida did last year. And that was a kind of an 18-month project, a four-part series that took in the history of, you know, since the year dot, you know, hunter-gatherers right the way through to the present day. And then followed quickly by a documentary by Ruan McGann on Daniel O'Connell. So it seemed to kind of, I was invited to write a piece of music that would somehow talk about the entwined nature of the Irish, the Welsh, the Scottish, the English, and complicated histories that we have and stories. And so I wrote this piece called Fitze Fwitze, which is the Irish word for, it comes from Fiadoracht, which is weaving. So the weave and the weft. And so it was a great, lovely kind of invitation and a way to kind of crystallize musically in some way our relationship. So the piece of music, that's the middle part. So it came as a triptych. The first part was kind of before history. And then the middle part is history, and which was the bit we heard. And then the last part is after history. And it was a lovely opportunity to work with musicians like Bríde Chaimbel and the small piper. She plays the small pipes she's from Ilan Skihanach, the Isle of Skye, and wonderful violinists from Wales, Raki and Simi Singh. And then from Manchester, we had Ben Castle on keyboard.
And are you playing on it?
I'm playing as well. Yeah, I'm playing the fiddle and play different things as well. Yeah. So it was just a lovely, lovely opportunity. And I suppose we have a new ambassador as well, Cara Owen, who's a very interesting, vibrant person. Tashi Treshiva Fulham Gaelge, which is very refreshing to have an Irish.
She's married to an Irishman.
She is indeed, yeah. It was just great, and it was a lovely thing. And it was premiered last night out in the Glencairn.
Lovely. It sounds beautiful. Look forward to hearing it all.
Nice.
And of course, the other thing, you're also a member of The Frames, and we've been doing our countdown, as voted by the listeners of Today FM, of the 100 greatest Irish songs of all time. And The Frames have two songs on the charts. Number 92 is Star Star, and Revelate is at number 31.
Well, that's great, yeah. It's good to be mentioned in dispatches all these years later.
How long did you stay with The Frames for?
Well, I suppose The Frames ran and are still running in a way. We get together to mark significant birthdays. But I suppose the success of Once and the film really kind of was the death knell of the Frames in a way where, you know, perhaps it was a bit of the post boxes being painted a different color as the swell season. But I think so that was the kind of the end of it, really. Though I stayed on and played with the swell season for, it was a very busy time after the Oscar win, and we had an incredible run, you know, playing Radio City and the, you know, the Opera House in Sydney.
How long ago was that now?
Well, that was, I'd say, well, the Oscar win was 2007, so that's a while ago now. And then that would have gone on, I think I got off the bus physically in about 2013. So that was a good 6-year run. And I think, for me at that stage, I suppose I'd made my first solo record in 2008, Queen and Yuria, the Hare's Corner, and that had come out in 2008. And then that really, there's a saying in the country where a taste of the grass makes a rogue of the beast. And having got the taste of the grass, is having the whole canvas to myself, it, you know, I think I was always heading in that direction afterwards, after that. So, yeah, I mean, thankfully, you know, bands are very kind of complicated and multi-layered relationships, you know, and very to play music with people, it has to be deep and emotional, and so it's a family. So definitely, kind of getting off the bus was a very onerous sort of decision, but one that's been very, you know, rewarding since, thankfully.
Yeah, but even though you sort of became an individual, you still are very collaborative by nature, aren't you? Not just even what you've told us about the work you did last night.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think that kind of traces back perhaps to my busking roots. So with Keela originally, we were street musicians, and that's how I would have met Glenn Hansard. And then that wider musical kind of troupe kind of fragmented or splintered into different kind of camps. So the Mary Janes and the Frames and the Pale was another band, and Keela as well. So there was always kind of a flexibility where, you know, whoever would rock up with playing with a hammer dulcimer would, you know, you'd accommodate them, or you'd figure out a way, or some people didn't speak English at all. And just having that kind of universal language, which is music, just it's just been a magic thing that's just, honestly, I mean, it's kind of like there's been no great master plan in my life other than just kind of one tune naturally follows the next one, you know. So it's just been a lovely thing. The more you trust it, the more it kind of rewards you.
Well, Culture Club allows us to go through some of your musical influences. So let's go back to the first single that you remember and buying. And this is a lovely one, Madness and Embarrassment. Tell us about why you picked that.
Well, I mean, it was literally the first piece of vinyl I ever bought. So I think 1980, I think it came out. So I would have been 9 years old. I'm not sure if that was with my communion money. I don't remember. But I remember actually going in, I think it was a shop called Sounds Around. Do you remember those? There was a chain of music shops. And it was either in Dunleary or in Stillorgan Shopping Centre. And the B-side, you know, you would have played these things I still have the record at home, very scratched, but yeah. And you know, the Madness just had a great energy. I remember they were kind of like one of the first bands to really kind of go for it as regards making videos, and they're always very fun. And
yeah, we had Suggs in here.
Oh, really?
He was a great character.
Yeah, and just they just had such a something that was very appealing. When I mean, it's kind of crazy to think back of how young I was as a 9 year old to be able to pick up on these things. But as well, I come from a big family, so I was fourth of six. I was very influenced by, you know, my older brothers and sisters who were mad into like different people, like, you know, Thin Lizzy or Stiff Little Fingers or Bob Dylan as well.
We'll get to all that. Let's hear a little bit of Madness and Embarrassment.
Think we don't, but I will, 'cause I know that you think I don't. Our uncle
disgrace to the human race.
Madness and embarrassment. Colm, there's a younger generation love madness. They come back and play quite regularly.
Yeah.
I think you'll find as many 20-somethings as 50-somethings in the audience loving the music.
Yeah, well, I suppose that is the thing that's so interesting with certain music. It doesn't gather dust.
Favourite album? You've given us two. Blood in the Tracks by Bob Dylan. And it's so many people on the Culture Club say a Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
What's Bob Dylan for you?
I suppose he's a chameleon, a cultural chameleon. I think he's the responsible for just literature, kind of music becoming a vehicle for literature, you know, and his writing somehow, just he manages to kind of, his songs are kind of short stories, and having been introduced, you know, by my older siblings to Bob Dylan. And it kind of wears you down, you know. Yeah, it's a bit like kind of whiskey that it doesn't taste very nice first time you drink it, but you know, after repeated listens, it just manages to make its way into your psyche. And I suppose with Blood in the Tracks, especially, it's kind of like a high watermark for me of his writing, where I think he's just recently divorced, and he's full of kind of recriminations and bitterness and just so many, like the every song has it's just one zinger after another, you know. So for me, I suppose my lyrical content is so important, whether I kind of believe a band or not, or believe a song. And that's from just, I suppose, growing up with Bob Dylan.
The other one you have is Pink Moon by Nick Drake. Tell us a bit about why you've picked that.
Yeah, we were introduced to Nick Drake by a band called Lear in the very early 90s. And this is kind of years before Nick Drake had a kind of a renaissance as such. I think they used a song in a commercial for Volkswagen in America in the early 2000s. And we were signed to Island Records at the time. And we were just in that lovely thing where we had his whole back catalogue available to us. Which we availed of. And Nick Drake, he just kind of contains multitudes as regards, there's just such a depth, musical depth, harmonically, lyrically. And it just, I suppose at the time, I probably spent 10 years listening to Nick Drake every day for sure. So he's definitely kind of an early, pole star for me, you know.
Okay, well, from the album Pink Moon, here's Nick Drake, Things Behind the Sun.
Please beware them that stare, they'll only smile to see why the time. Once you've seen what they've been to, and the earth just won't seem worth a night or a day. Oh yeah, what I say. Look around, you find the ground is not so far from where you are. Don't be too wise. For down below they never grow, they're always tired, and charms are hired from out of their eyes. Never a surprise. Take your time and you'll be fine. Say a prayer for people there.
Nick Drake, Things Behind the Sun, from the album Pink Moon. I wasn't familiar with Nick Drake. Listening to that, it reminds me a little bit of John Martin before he went electric.
Yeah, for sure. They're definite contemporaries and friends. Actually, I remember Dave from Lear, Dave McGuinness, meeting John Martin and telling us a story of kind of approaching John Martin sheepishly and asking him about Nick Drake, knowing that they used to be friends. And John Martin very gruffly saying, "I don't like to talk about dead people." So, Yeah.
Gruffness and John Martin sort of go together.
Indeed.
Okay, yeah. We've spoken about Bob Dylan as your favourite album and as your sort of favourite artist. You put him down as well. For your favourite band, The Botty Band. So before you tell us about The Botty Band, let's hear a little bit of The Kesh Jig. So, Colm, tell us all about The Botty Band.
Well, Matt, The Botty Band, what can you say? I mean, listening to it there just reminds me of the feeling that I got listening to Cooney and Begley for the first time. It's just like a chiropractor that it just straightens the back. Do you know what I mean? They had something, a swagger about them, I suppose. I would have only been a very small child when they were in their heyday. So I like a gateway drug for me, Moving Hearts was the band of my time. And then I would have traced those members back and discovered the Botty Band. So, you know, Donal Lunny, a super group. So Matt Malloy, Kevin Burke on fiddle, Donal Lunny, Micheál O'Donnell on the guitar. Triana Nigonel, his sister, on clavinet as well, which had they were very kind of rock and roll. And Paddy Keenan, of course, on pipes. Paddy's been sick at the moment, I believe, so I'll send him blessings to Paddy. So they're just an incredible, there's something about particular bands that they can, so not every band is the sum of its parts, you know. And with the Botty Band, they just are extraordinary, where every member brings this unique quality and that together they create something entirely new. And their music, I don't think there's been a better traditional group since, you know. And not to say that anything big is better or worse is music isn't a sport, but definitely a high watermark in traditional music.
Before we get to the break, I want to ask you about a best gig. Now, you've had countless gigs that I imagine being at as well as playing at. You've gone for the Flamour and Tremore in 1993. Why so?
Well, it was kind of like a high concentration of incredible gigs, one after the other. It was like a dream. We had just come from London, where we'd played with Bob Dylan as an opening act. And I remember myself and Glenn standing side of stage, chatting to Liam Clancy as we watched Bob Dylan's tour bus inch its way through the crowd, making its way towards the backstage. And while Liam told us all these stories of, you know, Greenwich Village in the early 60s and how this kid used to hang around, his name is Bobby, and then watching Dylan, the bus pull up, and we'd been just around the camp as well. So watching Joan Baez was on the same bill, and Dylan, the tour manager gets off Dylan's bus and goes over and knocks on Joan Baez's dressing room, and Baez's dressing room empties, and Dylan comes out of his bus with his hood up, and you see them both talk in silhouette in the window. And we're there chatting to Liam Clancy. And it's just like one of those moments it's like being in Don't Look Back, having known that film so well. And then another at the same festival, watching Ray Charles with his orchestra with the full moon behind him. Another incident where I walked into this tent and saw this guy play. And since then, I've never seen anybody enjoy playing a gig more or being enjoyed by an audience more, and it turned out to be John Prine.
We don't have any music from the Fla in Flamore and Tremor in 1993, but what we've actually managed to source is a clip from the RT report at the time from reporter Michael Ryan.
Wow.
Beamed down on the continuous stream of young music fans who crowded into the seaside resort for what was billed as the biggest music festival of its type ever staged in this country, which brought in some of the big names of world music. On stage here was Jimmy Cliff, beating out the decibels from an enormous mobile stage and a battery of amplifiers, which pumped the sound out onto Tremor Racecourse and to a crowd who had paid £25 a day for their tickets. And the music ranged from the Pogues to Van Morrison, from Ray Charles to Bob Dylan. In the mix, too, was Christy Moore. In all, the programme had 67 acts performing on three stages, with practically non-stop performances from noon to midnight. It meant a huge logistical and security operation, and Gardaí took some young people into custody to let the effects of drink wear off.
Like a 20th century electric picnic, yeah, as well,
exactly.
Isn't it?
And bless him, I think, you know, Vince Power, whose idea it was. Exactly. And what a legend. And just the I think he lost his hat on it, probably, you know, but it was just an
incredible festival. He bounced back. He always bounced
back. Yes, indeed. Yeah.
So let's get into movies. We also asked for an actor, movie, a director. So you've given us things like The Revenant as a favourite movie.
Yeah, favorite movie. I mean, we're supposed there's so many movies these days. What I took as what my favorite movie is. What's the movie that once it comes on, you know, if you stumble on it, that you'll watch it till the end every time, kind of thing. And I find that with The Revenant, there's an honesty and a rawness to it that I think it was very refreshing to me. I think as the first honest portrayal of settler colonialism and and here we are kind of centuries later and with the legacy of that interaction. So there's amazing performances, obviously from Leonardo DiCaprio and from our own Donald Gleeson, incredible cast. And, It was just so honest and brutal and beautiful as well. The whole idea of nature is it's just shot incredibly, and there's just that sense of there's just lots of silence in the film as well, which is a rare thing these days.
Actor, you go for Paul Newman.
Yeah, I suppose that again, that's kind of growing up in that time in the 70s. With watching those films, actually the film that springs to mind is Cool Hand Luke, and I suppose a very beautiful, charismatic Paul Newman. When movie stars were movie stars, I suppose.
And then for directors, the Coen brothers.
Yes, the Coen brothers, because just they always are guaranteed to make an interesting movie about things that people don't necessarily make movies about. So all the way through, I just happened to see, I remember seeing Barton Fink, which I think was their early movie, maybe before Miller's Crossing, around the same time. And just ever since then, just being loving the absurdity and the quirkiness of their characters. And you know, all the way through to Lebowski and, you know, the Fargo, and, you know, it's just reliably rewarding.
We asked you for a best author, and you've nominated Colin McCann, who, when he was here doing Culture Club previously, nominated your music. And that's fair enough, because you've worked together and you are working at the moment, aren't you, on a soundtrack to his wonderful novel, A Paragon.
Yes, I went to the West Bank and Israel went to Palestine and Israel with Colm in 2019, just before lockdown, and spent 2 weeks there and just had my kind of, as Heaney would put it, had my heart blown open. I was reading an advanced copy of Our Paragon while being there and meeting Rami and Bassam, who the novel is written about, at the same time. So it was very much like reading the screenplay and being in the movie at the same time. And I was musically thunderstruck. So it's been kind of an ongoing labor of love these past few years, gathering music, which I'm going to be recording later in the year for an album, which is my response to Rami and Bassam's story and the novel, of course, A Paragon. Yeah.
Let's hear a little bit from the beginning of A Paragon, read by Colm.
The hills of Jerusalem are a bath of fog. Rami moves by memory through a straight stretch and calculates the camber of an upcoming turn. 67 years old, he bends low on the motorbike, his jacket padded, his helmet clipped tight. It is a Japanese bike, 750cc, an agile machine for a man his age. Rami pushes the bike hard, even in bad weather. He takes a sharp right at the gardens where the fog lifts to reveal dark corpus separatum. He downshifts and whips past a military tower. The sodium lights appear fuzzy in the morning. A small flock of birds momentarily darkens the orange. At the bottom of the hill, the road dips into another curve, obscured in fog. He taps down to second, lets out the clutch, catches the corner smoothly, and moves back up to third. Road number one stands above the ruins of Colonia, all history piled here. He throttles at the end of the ramp, takes the inner lane, passing signs for the old city, for Givatram. The highway is a scattershot of morning headlights. He leans left and salmons his way out into the faster lane, towards the tunnels, the separation barrier, the town of Beit Jala. Two answers for one swerve. Gilo on one side, Bethlehem on the other.
Salmon's his way. I haven't heard that as a verb before.
Fantastic, yeah.
But it's a great image, actually.
It really is, yeah.
Okay, that's Colm McCann and A Paragon. What did you watch on TV when you were growing up?
I suppose the answer to that is everything, which my family will laugh at. You couldn't get me away from the telly, to be honest. One of my vivid memories is getting our first colour television. Our dad also was a newsreader on RTE, so we would often do that thing of, you know, it was probably 7 o'clock, whether it's our bedtime, whatever, which kind of coincided with the bulletin, the Nuacht bulletin. And so the memory of kind of kissing him goodnight and getting the buzz of static on your nose. So that was my relationship with the television. And our first colour television, I remember we were halfway through Bridge Over the River Kwai, and on a black and white telly, when it was a Pi set that you changed with the clunk clunk of a like a wheel. And the new, this colour TV, Bush TV arrived. And so just, it was like, it was nearly, you could say it was my first hallucinogenic experience of like turning those, everything went to Technicolour. It was like the Wizard of Oz or whatever. So suddenly seeing those greens, and it's all in the jungle, obviously. So that was, and then beyond that, all those great, you know, Billy Connolly, Dave Allen, watching those with my folks, Parkinson, you know, a Late Late Show was such a big thing. The top of the Pops are obviously would have been a weekly, sacrament.
Let's have a listen to a little bit of Dave Allen, which talking about the Irish wake on his BBC show.
A very important part of the Irish way of life is death. See, if anybody else, anywhere else in the world dies, that's the end of it, they're dead. But in Ireland, when somebody dies, we lay him out and watch him for a couple of days. Call a wake. And it's a party, it's a send-off. And the fellow's laid out on the table. And there's drinking and dancing and all the food you can eat. And all your friends come from all over the place. And they all stand around the wake table looking at you with a glass in their hands, and they say, "Here's to your health." And the terrible thing about dying over there is that you miss your own wake. It's the best day of your life. You paid for everything and you can't join in. Mind you, if you did, you'd be drinking on your own.
The first great Irish observational comedian. Listen, just to finish, buried treasure, we always ask. And tell us about the book you've selected for us.
Yeah, this is a book called the Tao Te Ching is how you say it. And it's kind of, would be the Tao Te Ching. If you're to look at it, it's a 2,500-year-old book written by a philosopher called Lao Tzu, who's this enigmatic character. And it's sort of, I suppose it's the cornerstone of Taoism. Taoism is this philosophy of, which is essentially breaks down to realizing that letting go of the illusion of control and so trusting in the flow of the river of life and realizing that all suffering is trying to hold onto the bank rather than letting go. And it's just, there's a particular translation as well by a writer called Stephen Mitchell, which is just particularly good.
Well, we have a little bit of that read by Sir Nigel Hawthorne.
Oh, lovely.
The Tao that can be talked about is not the true Tao. The name that can be named is not the eternal name. Everything in the universe comes out of nothing. Nothing, the nameless, is the beginning, while heaven, the mother, is the creatrix of all things. Follow the nothingness of the Tao, and you can be like it, not needing anything, seeing the wonder and the root of everything. And even if you cannot grasp this nothingness, you can still see something of the Tao in everything. These two are the same, only called by different names, and both are mysterious and wonderful. All mysteries are Tao, and heaven is their mother. She is the gateway and the womb door.
Colin McNamara, unfortunately, I'm out of time and I have to finish there. It has been so enjoyable having nice you one. Here for the Culture Club. Thank you so much. And a big thank you to my entire production team, led tonight by Dermot Doyle. Back tomorrow at 4:30. Until then, from me, Matt Cooper, have a very good evening.
The Last Word on Today FM.